Welcome back to the MLB.com StatCast podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello, joined here by MLB.com national editor Matt Myers, and it is our first podcast of the offseason. I think the last time we talked was directly before Game 1 of the World Series, where we had hoped we would have an exciting and interesting World Series, and I don't know, I would say it lived up to that, and then some. Would you agree?
Yes, it was, although Game 7 was a little bit of a letdown on the excitement meter, everything leading up to that exceeded expectations, so I think it balanced out, and it definitely was in the conversation for most exciting World Series that I've ever seen.
I was fortunate enough to be at the first two games in Los Angeles, and in addition to it being extremely hot, 103 degrees the first day, it was a lot of fun to watch in person, especially Game 2, which was the nuttiest game I'd ever seen, only up until we saw Game 5. So, as we know, the Astros walk away from the 2017 World Series as the champions, and we want to just do a little bit of wrap-up on the World Series, because it was really fascinating, and then look ahead a little bit to free agency, which I can't believe starts almost like right now. It's amazing to think that we're already looking ahead to 2018 already. But as far as the World Series goes, I think, you know, a couple of stories out of the World Series. Part of it was, you know, as we talked about, just the excitement. And, you know, as my wife was shocked to learn, you can actually quantify excitement. You can do this. You can look at win probability, which basically looks at the change in expected win outcome from play to play. It's a good way. A lot of our stats are context free. We don't really look at game situation, but this one is, you know, a home run in the first inning when you're, you know, tied at 0-0 is different from a home run to win the game in the ninth is different from a home run when it's a 10-0 blowout. So this is a great way to put these games into actual context. And we saw two games in this World Series, Game 2 and Game 5. They were the only World Series games ever that have five different plays that changed the outcome of the game by at least 25%, which is nutty when you think about it. Like, that doesn't happen. And then in the entire history of the World Series, it happened twice in the span of, like, 4 days.
Yeah, and the play that had, if I'm not mistaken, the play that had the highest win probability swing is a game that's going to be, is a moment that's going to be completely lost to history, which was Kike Hernandez's game-tying single in Game 2, I guess, off Giles?
I saw that list, you're exactly right. I was like, yeah, wait, I kind of remember that, right? Like, there's so much that happened.
It was off Giles, and it was like it was a crazy play in its own right, because Hernandez is a pretty strong pull hitter, and he was facing a right-handed pitcher, and he can't hit right-handed pitching, and of course he hits like a ground ball perfectly towards where second base would be, like, traditionally be positioned for a clean single to tie the game. But then of course the Astros went on to hit like four more home runs in extra innings of that game, and it was completely washed away.
And there's another way to quantify this too. So you look at win percentage added, or win probability added, WPA, and that's within the context of a single game. But if you change what you're looking at, you can look at a stat that's known as championship WPA, which means it's not about how much did you do with that play to increase your odds of winning that game to winning the entire World Series. And obviously that changes a lot. This was the ninth highest World Series of all time in terms of championship win probability added. And if you look at some of the ones ahead of them, they're exactly the ones you'd expect. There's some classics here. You know, 91, Minnesota-Atlanta goes seven games. 97, Florida and Cleveland go seven games. Just a couple years ago, the Texas-St. Louis 2011 series was wild. And then going all the way back to 1975, Reds and Red Sox. I mean, that's the, you know, the Carlton Fisk game. So this really stacks up with some of the all-time greats. You can also look at it as an average championship WPA per plate appearance, just like how much does plate appearance matter. And this was the seventh highest World Series of all time by that metric. And I think that's really interesting. That just goes to show, even with Game 7 not really living up to like excitement expectations, overall, this was, you can say this is like the craziest World Series that you've seen and not really be like completely out of your mind about it.
I mean, I think on a standalone basis, Game 5 was the craziest World Series game I've ever seen. However, Game 6 of 2011, the Nelson Cruz David Freese game, is elevated above it in my mind because it was an elimination game.
Right.
Like one of the teams could have, you know, if Texas had won, the Cardinals were out.
Yes.
That, so in this series, the one thing that sort of like hurts it is that none of the elimination games were great. Game 6 and 7 might have been the two least exciting games of the series.
I mean, that's true. And Game 7 was great, even though it you know, ended on a 4-3 ground out from Corey Seager over to Jose Altuve. Let's take a second and just remember how cool that sounded.
Here's a ground ball right side. Could do it. The Houston Astros are world champions for the first time in franchise history.
So congratulations to the Astros. I think obviously everybody in the world by now knows the story. They were on the cover of Sports Illustrated in 2014 saying they'd be the 2017 World Series champions. I do wonder how differently that would look now if they had said the exact same prediction, but it wasn't George Springer on the cover. You know, it was like Brett Oberholzer or John Singleton or something like that. I think that'd be an interesting alternate universe. But it worked out for them because George Springer was fantastic. We'll get to him in a second. One of the stories I think of this World Series quite obviously was the home runs, right? As it's been all season long. There were a record 25 home runs hit in the World Series, and I think there's a lot of different reasons for that. Partially, these are just two very, very good offenses, probably the two best in baseball. We also saw that the somewhat overused relievers kind of led to some meatballs right down the middle for some of these home runs. But what I find the most interesting is we saw this series really being played in three different ballparks, right? We saw game one and two in LA. It was extremely hot. And I think we talked about this last week, how we expected that the temperature would lead to some home runs, and it did. Games 3-5 in Houston, obviously the short left field porch turned some easy pop-ups into home runs. And then 6-7 LA, it was, you know, normalish, as normal as it gets. And I thought this was interesting. Of the 25 home runs we saw, five of them had a hit probability of under 25%, which is really interesting. And you can see exactly why. Like Carlos Correa, for example, in game five, had a ball that was 48 degrees of launch angle, right? And what do we ended up looking at? That was the highest hit home run of the year?
Or of 2017, regular season and postseason, and also the highest, not surprisingly, in the postseason we've seen in the 3 years of StatCast.
Yeah, 48 degrees. I mean, we basically consider anything above 50 degrees a pop-up, right? I mean, pop-ups are never, ever outs, or never hits. They're strikeouts. But that went into the short left field in Houston, so 11% hit probability. We saw Turner get one in game one, a 13% hit probability, 103 degrees. Obviously, that helped that ball. It wasn't hit that hard, you know, 96 miles an hour. In game four, Alex Bregman hit one only 93 miles an hour. That got out because he hit it into the Crawford boxes. And then also in game two, it was still 93 degrees. We saw Peterson hit one, 97 degrees, 22%. My favorite, I think, was actually Puig's in the Wild game five, because if you remember the way he hit it, it didn't look good, right? Just visually, it did not look like a solid swing. He still got 96 miles an hour on it, so that's great. But it only went 349 feet. That ball's a home run 2% of the time. It's a hit 33% of the time, but it almost never goes out. It's really interesting to see how the ballpark, how the environment made some of these home runs happen.
Like, my favorite fact of the series in that game five was Gurriel hit a double to deep left center off the wall that went 400 feet. In that game, there were five home runs hit that didn't go as far as Gurriel's double. That, like, tells you just how weird. You know, we've talked a lot this season on this podcast about the weirdness of Minute Maid Park. And in this series, it totally lived up to that reputation that we've sort of been building up for, because it had all of these kind of quote-unquote cheap home runs. Although almost, the thing is, you see a fair amount to right field at Minute Maid Park as well. But in this series, it was almost exclusively the left field Crawford box variety.
Yeah, and it's really, this is why we like getting to these stats, like expected weighted on base, that are about quality of contact, right? Because it's what happened at the moment the ball hit the bat. Because the beauty of baseball is there's so many different ballparks, there's so many different environments that a lot of things can happen. The outcome doesn't necessarily lend itself directly to the skill that went into it, you know, because you can't control the ballpark, you can't control the defense. All you can control as a hitter is how hard you hit the ball, what angle, and what direction. And that's unlike any other sport, I think.
Yeah, I do think, I wonder about parks like Minute Maid and Fenway in particular, where there's some glaring feature that, like, I think that hitters can adjust their swings to try and, like, we're like, I mean, I think when I think of Fenway Park, I think of left-handed hitters sort of like basically trying to hit, you know, fly ball, like trying to like go the other way with like kind of routine fly balls to left, knowing that that is often a double. And I think that you probably kind of do some of the same in the Crawford boxes. I think most parks hitters aren't doing that because there's nothing that's like so obvious, like, oh, if I just like adjust my swing a little bit, I can get some sort of like cheap extra base hit. But I do think that that in certain parks, you might get that. And it's hard. It's one of those things that's really hard to quantify.
So the MVP of the series was George Springer. And I think it's pretty funny because he was pretty lousy leading up to the World Series. He did not have a strong postseason leading up to the World Series.
He was like 3-for-26 in the ALCS.
Yeah, and then in game one of the World Series, 0-for-4 with four strikeouts. I was seeing Astros fans on Twitter wanting him to be benched, which is nutty, and I get it, but still. And then
it's particularly nutty when you consider that the Astros basically had no bench in this
series. What are you gonna do, start Cameron Maybin in center field? Derek Fisher, you know, had like one interesting moment. Did we actually make it through the whole series of that Juan Centeno appearing?
He never appeared.
He had like one plate appearance the entire postseason. So Springer starts off 0-for-4 with four strikeouts in game one, and then 11-for-25, three doubles, five home runs. This is maybe my favorite stat of the entire postseason. Of those 25 post-game one plate appearances, he had 17 hard-hit balls, which we quantify as 95 miles an hour or above. 17-for-25. That's not 17-for-25 batted balls. That's 17-for-25 times just stepping to the plate, which is insane. He also had the two longest and hardest hit home runs of the record 25 we saw. In game three, he hit 110.3 miles an hour, 438 feet. And then in game seven, this was really the dagger. And this is where you knew Yu Darvish probably should have been out two batters earlier. 111.9 miles an hour, 448 feet off the bat. Let's take a minute to listen to what that sounded like.
Here comes the 3-2. And George drills this one deep to left center field. You can kiss that one goodbye. A two-run home run for George Springer. And the Astros lead it 5-0. Springer homers for the fourth straight game.
So Dave Roberts, I think, got some heat for not bringing in Morrow for that situation, which in retrospect, I guess I agree with. I mean, it just seemed like there was no way that was going to work out. Darvish looked terrible. Springer was red hot. That maybe was, I don't care about, you know, Rich Hill in game two. I thought that was the right call. I thought Roberts did a good job. That's probably the one maybe I differ with him on.
Yeah, the thing about the Darvish is, like, you know, in the first inning, he definitely got a little bit of a raw deal because he gave up that double to Springer to lead it off. But then, like, it was a slow roller at first. Bellinger made a bad play on. He should have let Forsyth field it and throw to first. Instead, he fielded it, and, you know, being a lefty, he tried to open up his body, made an awkward throw. Bregman safe, gets the second, steals third. So it's like 2-0, but then it's 2-0 before you know it, but there's only really one hard-hit ball of the inning. That said, it was pretty clear Darvish was not missing bats. In game two, he had one swing and a miss. In game seven, he had, I think it was two, but one of them was a bunt.
Right.
So he really had only one swing strike, and his location wasn't great. It just, after, you can if you want to check our internal Slack just discussion, after Marwin's double in the second, I said Darvish needs to be out of this game. And so that was the first guess. And Roberts, that was probably – he had a few weird decisions. He had some – I thought a lot of times, to your point, he was excellent with his quick hook with the starting pitchers, and I agreed with him. He had a few odd choices. Kike Hernandez bunting in game five was bizarre.
With Justin Turner on second, and who was playing DH that day because he'd hurt his leg.
That was bad, but the sticking with Darvish too long in game seven when you know you have the full pen, including Clayton Kershaw and Alex Wood ready to come in, that was his biggest sin, managerial sin as far as I'm concerned. It bit him because he kept him in for Springer and he absolutely obliterated the pitch.
Yeah, and we'll get to free agency in a second. I'm not one that really believes that a game or two in the postseason is going to significantly change the contract a guy like Darvish is going to get, but these were two really bad starts, and he talked a little bit about how, you know, the ball didn't feel right to him. Maybe there was something to do with he was tipping his pitches. That came up afterwards. I don't have a good answer for why this happened.
Well, it was interesting because his last start with Texas, he wasn't great with Texas here. In his last start, the Marlins beat the Rangers like 22-10.
He gave up 10 runs, I think.
After the game, he basically said, yeah, I realize I've been tipping my pitches. I'm pausing when I throw my fastball. I'm pausing when I leg kick when I throw my fastball. And I'm not doing when I'm throwing my breaking ball. And like something I need to address. And he pitched well with the Dodgers. If that was an issue, he seemed to have addressed it. But in game seven post-game, Carlos Beltran said that he had told his teammates, hey, Darvish is tipping his pitches. I don't know if Darvish's quote unquote tell was the same as what it had been in July, but this had been a storyline for Darvish this year. And Beltran on the postgame, Joe, was interesting because he was saying, you know, Beltran, a pretty modest guy, was basically trying not to take too much credit. He was basically saying, I noticed this, but, you know, a lot of hitters don't like that information because they don't think they can do anything with it. So it's almost like, don't tell me this because it's going to cloud my head. But it's possible that Springer, who hit two absolute rockets off Darvish, was using this information, and maybe Marwin Gonzalez too, who hit a hard double into right center as well.
It wouldn't surprise me at all that Darvish, as you said, was very good with the Dodgers before that. He gave up one run, I believe, in each of his two postseason starts before the World Series. So to see this happen, obviously the Astros are an elite offense. That was kind of shocking. Springer, by the way, tied for the sixth highest WPA win probability added in a World Series of all time. You will not be surprised to see that Madison Bumgarner 2014 is on that list, Jack Morris in 1991, and tied for the 10th highest championship WP added in World Series of all time, despite going 0-4 in game one.
One thing that's interesting about Springer in the context of the Astros, and obviously I think, you know, Jeff Luhnow, the GM, and his whole front office deserve all the credit in the world for many of the moves that they've made. But it is interesting that, and this sort of gets lost a little bit in the discussion, is that arguably their two best players this year, Springer and Altuve, both homegrown, both predate the Luhnow administration.
And that's true for Keuchel as well, isn't it? Right?
He was drafted in like 2008 or 9. I can't remember which one it is. But, you know, Springer was particularly interesting because Springer was drafted in June of 2011. Luhnow hired that December. So he basically was like just in before. So, you know, Ed Wade and Tipper Pura before him, you know, got sort of a bit of a laughing stock with their Houston regime, but they definitely got some things right, and they definitely left Luno. The cupboard was not bare when Luno came over. Basically, three superstars in waiting, and you know, they helped develop Luno and his team, helped develop those guys, but the talent was obviously there.
Yeah, and it's somewhat similar for the Dodgers. Obviously, they didn't start with 100 lost seasons when the quote-unquote nerds came in. They'd won two division titles, but, you know, Seager was in the minor leagues, Bellinger was in the minor leagues, Kershaw was already there. So they made a lot of moves, but as you said, they didn't come in and starting from scratch. Before we move on from the World Series, I do want to talk about what I found maybe to be the most interesting moment of the World Series. In Game 7, you know, Lance McCullers starts, and he only went 2 1/3 inning, and he set a postseason record by hitting four batters, right? He faced 13 hitters, hit four of them, gave up six batted balls at 95 miles an hour or harder. Three of those had a 65% hit probability or more. To be fair, he did strike out three. He made Cody Bellinger look foolish on curveballs twice, and he got Seager once as well. But 2 1/3 innings, no runs, and that would be what you would consider dealing, right? I mean, but I'm saying the outcome is dealing. You don't pull a guy in that situation, usually.
Usually you do not.
So he got pulled, and I found this really interesting. This has never happened before. This exact situation has never happened before in World Series history. There have been 659 World Series games before Game 7. So, obviously, there's two different starters per game. That's over 1,300 previous World Series starts. Only three times before had a starter been pulled without any runs allowed before three innings were up. Now, two of them were injuries. In 2003, David Wells came out of Game 5 because he'd hurt his back. In 1988, John Tudor came out of Game 2 because he'd hurt his elbow. And in 1924, there was a gimmick that was way ahead of its time that I'd actually love to see somebody try this again. The Washington Senators, in Game 7, started right-handed pitcher Curly Ogden and gave him two batters before removing him for a lefty because they wanted to remove the platoon advantage from the other side, which I love that, by the way. That's fantastic.
The Pirates and Jimmy Leland did that in the NLCS in, like, 1990 with, like, I want to say, like, Bob Walk and Zane Smith. I may be getting the name slightly off, but they did that gamut.
That was almost 100 years ago. I want to see that happen again. The point being, the only three previous times a pitcher had been pulled starting a World Series game without allowing a run before three innings were a platoon gimmick or two injuries. This doesn't ever happen. For like the entirety of World Series history, you leave that guy in until he gives up a run. But A.J. Hinch didn't do that. He came out and got him. And I think that changes the World Series right there.
This was interesting to me for a few reasons, one of which was, and this speaks to their confidence in having McCullers and how lost they thought Cody Bellinger was, is that they let McCullers face Bellinger, strike him out on three breaking balls, basically at his back foot, and then took him out.
Right.
Basically, like, we know that we were completely confident he's going to strike out Bellinger, and then we're going to take him out. That was almost the weirdest part about it, was that they let him face a guy, dominate him, and then take him out. I guess it was, who came in? It was Peacock that came in?
I believe it was Peacock, yeah.
Who came in to face? Who bats after Bellinger?
I can't even remember at this point. Peterson, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, but whatever. That to me that was fascinating. What also was fascinating was that post game, McCullers was pretty candid, saying like, "Yeah, I told them the day before I didn't think I had much in me," which is interesting because he was on full rest.
He was on full rest, but you know, it's been a long season. Obviously, it's November. Yeah. He looked only okay in his previous start.
That's true.
I think by comparison to Yu Darvish, he looked great, but he only had looked okay. And then A.J. Hinch was quoted after the game saying, you know, I didn't really plan on pulling him this early, but he was spraying his fastball over the place. Obviously, hit four. He didn't look good at all.
Well, no, with the exception of getting Bellinger to swing and miss like eight times. And
right.
Two.
Well, there's that.
But other than that, I mean, you
make a great point, right? Because it was clear to me like two batters earlier, like this guy's done. You can't leave him in. But they left him in specifically to throw curveballs to Cody Bellinger. And it worked out wonderfully. And I really think in so many other situations, a manager probably leaves the guy in because he's not allowed to run. And, you know, all these hard hit balls are not always going to turn in outs. You know, he loaded the bases in the first inning and he got, a double play. This is not really the normal way that you approach these things. And I thought that was a big turning point.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, they definitely got lucky. I think it was the second inning. First inning, it was a hard ground ball hit right at Altuve.
Right. End of
the
second inning was the
second inning was the line drive right at Correa.
Rushed.
Like perfectly hit right at him and doubled, I guess it was Forsythe, I think.
I think
doubled,
it was Forsythe.
Good, doubled off. And that was when it was like, you know what, this doesn't feel like the Dodgers.
Yeah. Today. Well, I mean, that's true, but it's an interesting way, I think, to look at process over outcome. Because if you leave him in, maybe he gives up runs, maybe that game gets lost.
Yeah. One sort of cool tidbit that was brought to my attention by Zach Kreiser, one of our works on our alerts team, and Jason Catania, who mentioned this, is that the Astros a few years ago were one of the teams, and this was part of like when they were still kind of being mocked for being forward thinking, had aggressively implemented tandem starters at all levels of the minors. A lot of teams over the last 10, 15 years have done it like in low A and maybe high A because they have like, you know, 10 guys they're trying to develop as starting pitchers, but not enough starts to to go around. And for those who aren't unfamiliar, tandem starters basically means we're going to cap you at like 75 pitches. We'll have one starter throw the first four innings, another guy come in, and then we'll use true relievers after that. And the Astros in 2013 and 14 did this at all levels of their system. And it's interesting in the sense that, like, this postseason in particular, particularly in the World Series, once they lost faith in Giles and Davidsky, and they were basically using all their starters as relievers, a lot of the guys had actually been through that before and had some experience doing it. You know, like McCullers famously was the first example in this postseason in Game 7 of the ALCS, came in like the sixth and threw four innings to close it out for Morton. McCullers was in the system in 2013. He'd done this many times. Brad Peacock, same thing. And while I'm not necessarily saying there's like a direct correlation, it's interesting that like this quote-unquote controversial like method they'd implemented, because they were doing it even at AAA in 13 and 14, sort of manifested itself in the World Series, and they executed it perfectly.
Yeah, I think this is the future of quote-unquote bullpenning. I think if there was one failure on the LA side, it was that Roberts was too heavily reliant on Jansen, Morrow, and Kenta Maeda. Like, Josh Fields basically didn't appear all postseason. McCarthy, Ross Stripling. I mean, these are not elite guys, but they're talented guys. And I think, you know, you need to have some more faith in some of these guys in situations. Like, you don't need Jansen to nail down a four-run lead. You know, if you can't trust these guys, then the other guys get overworked. And I really like exactly what you said that the Astros did here. And I think they're well positioned to keep doing that. And then, you know, baseball's a copycat sport. Some other team is going to try this, and I think it's going to be really interesting. And then the only other thing I think is interesting as far as what the Astros did is that, you know, their offense this year was elite. We talked about this for a lot of different reasons. They also had this enormous drop in strikeout rate. I think they dropped from like 24% last year to 17% this year. And I don't necessarily think that that specifically leads to success, right? You know, people like to talk about that with the Royals. But what I do wonder is, since the way the game has changed to really be more home run focused, right? It's a lot easier to hit a home run than it used to be. Will teams just try to get more contact because you figure anytime you can put the bat on the ball, you're more likely to get success out of it than you were in the past? I don't know. It's an interesting, I think, thread for this offseason to come.
I think it would certainly be something that from a aesthetic standpoint would be welcome.
Yes, I agree with that for sure.
So if people want to can manage to copycat the Astros formula of more dingers, less strikeouts, like, by all means.
Absolutely. So that's it for the World Series. That was a total blast. I enjoyed that. And really, the whole season was a lot of fun. And it is amazing that we are already looking forward to next year. Free agents, 149 players became free agents. There'll be a couple more as options are and are not exercised. And free agents can sign as of 5 p.m. Eastern on Monday, November 6th.
They could sign with new teams. Between now and Monday, they can sign.
We've already seen Justin Upton, yeah, exactly. At a year. So they can sign with new teams as of Monday. And we know we're going to talk a lot, obviously, over the next couple months about, you know, who's good fit where, what teams need what. But what we want to do right away is just kind of look at what skills are available on the market. You know, if you are looking for a throwing arm, if you're looking for a fast runner, well, we can kind of do that better this year than we've ever been able to do with StatCast. So we've got a couple categories here that we want to go through, and I think this will be kind of interesting to get a read on what the market's going to be. So, for example, if you are a team and you're simply looking for quality of contact, like who is the most productive hitter, obviously we use expected weighted on base that accounts for quality of contact with launch angle and exit velocity, and also it does use strikeouts and walks. I think the biggest name is probably going to be Eric Hosmer, right? He's probably going to be the one that everybody thinks about, but he's not the best hitter as far as I'm concerned. That's JD Martinez. And I think a lot of people saw what he did after he went to Arizona, where he went totally nuts and said, wow, you know, where did this guy come from? That's pretty false. He's been a great hitter for the last couple years. His quality of contact this year, he had a 423 expected weighted on base. The league average is like 320. But even over the last three seasons, his expected weighted on base was 402. I mean, this is a guy, you know, he's not a strong outfielder, but he's been an elite hitter for some time now.
Yeah, and you mentioned Upton sort of instead of opting out of his contract with the Angels, he essentially signed a new contract. As you know, now he's a five-year deal to stay in Anaheim. And that's the biggest winner there might actually be JD Martinez, is because if Upton's on the market, their profiles are very similar. Left fielders, right-handed hitters, not much defensive value, but they can mash. And now, like, Upton was going to be out there, there's going to be kind of two options, so teams could sort of play them against each other. But now, like, if you're looking for a right-handed power bat, he's the guy.
Yeah, and, you know, I hate to, like, look at the most obvious fit and then think that'll happen, because it never happens, but it really seems obvious he's going to end up with the Red Sox. They hit no home runs this year. Dombrowski obviously knows him well from Detroit. I mean, that just seems like the most obvious fit.
Yeah, but I think they'd have to move an outfielder. And I know John Paul Morosi's talked about how they could trade Jackie Bradley Jr., which, you know, certainly I think of their outfielders, he's the guy they'd be most likely to be willing to trade. But I don't necessarily think they'd bring in Martinez just to be DH.
Not just to be DH, but I think you could split time between DH if you think Hanley can play some first base. For starting pitcher, it's the same exact thing. Who is the best starting pitcher with the quality, lowest quality of contact? Now, there's some interesting starters in this year's market. Yu Darvish. If you're just looking at 2017, of the free agents, Yu Darvish had a 291 expected weighted on base, which is very, very good. Now, if you obviously want more sample size over the last 3 years, it's Jake Arrieta, a 277 expected weighted on base. But that gets a little interesting because that includes his unbelievable year in 2015. And if you look at Arrieta for the last couple of years, ERA has gone up from 177 to 310 to 353, expected weighted on base from 242, which is wild, to 293 to 301. So you're obviously going to look at more than just 2017, but I think Arrieta is going to be maybe the most interesting case because I think he is going to be looking for a massive deal, but he's also a guy, he's over 30, he's kind of going the wrong way. I don't really know how that's going to end up.
Yeah, I would be very wary. There's a lot of like sort of lower, you know, sort of second tier arm, quote unquote second tier arms I'd much rather sort of take a chance on than Jake Arrieta.
For relievers, I think this one's really interesting. You think about relievers in the market this year, you think Wade Davis, you think Greg Holland, right? Pat Neshek. Pat Neshek had a 216 expected weighted on base. Now, he made the All-Star team. This year, he's not a total nobody. And then over the last 3 years, also Pat Neshek, 250 expected weighted on base. Now, let's be totally fair here. He's 37. He doesn't throw all that hard. He is not going to get a bigger contract than these other guys like Davis and Holland. But I find it really interesting that if you actually look, you know, beyond the eye test and what's actually happened, Neshek has been fantastic for several years now.
And for sure, no, Neshek has had a great career. Although it's also fair to note that he's more of a situational reliever, so he's put in more often to, like,
for sure,
in positions to succeed, where he's put it up against righties that the manager knows he has a very good chance of retiring, whereas, like, guys like Holland and Davis are put in to start innings, usually the ninth, regardless of who's coming up, sometimes to their benefit, but often it's like the heart of the order, lefties, righties, what have you.
100% true. A couple other names to watch for relievers. Brandon Morrow obviously had a great year for the Dodgers, 240 expected weighted on base. And Mike Minor for the Royals. We'll get back to him in a second. A 238 expected weighted base. I think he's going to have a really interesting market as a former starter. For outfield range, if you're looking for outfield defense, there's not a ton of great options out here. The big name, Lorenzo Cain. I think that makes sense. This is where the eye test and the metrics align pretty well. He had a plus 15 mark for outs above average this year. I think that was tied for sixth overall over the last two seasons, plus 27 outs above average. Really, the only other good option here is Jarrod Dyson, who was plus seven, even though he kind of missed part of the season. This is really, it's an outfield market full of kind of the older hittery types like JD Martinez, Granderson, Melky Cabrera, etc. So if you're looking for defense, I think these are really the only two places you can possibly look. It really seems obvious that Kane's going to go to the Giants or the Mets or somebody like that, right?
Both those teams seem like very, very good fits for him. Just they're likely to be spenders in free agency, and they could use outfield defense. And, you know, there will be a good market for him.
Yeah, I think I was going to say he might do the best out of all the Royals, but that's probably not true. Hosmer probably gets
the Hosmer's going to do the best.
I'd say he'll be the best value of all those Royals. We'll say that.
I could see that.
Foot speed's a really interesting one. We use sprint speed to measure our fastest runners. Where 27 feet per second is the league average, and 30 feet per second is elite. Rajay Davis.
Still.
And we talked a lot when we first put out sprint speed that speed peaks early and it declines, and that's true, but there are outliers. Rashid Davis, 29.2 feet per second. Essentially, this is a tie with Kane, who was 29.1, and Peter Burgos, who was 29 even. But Rashid Davis, 36 years old, had 29 stolen bases. It was his 11th straight year with 18 stolen bases. I mean, you can't be this fast forever, certainly, but I mean, this is still elite skill right here. He's going to find a job with somebody as their fourth outfielder, and they'll be very happy to have him.
Good for him.
If you want an outfield throwing arm, Carlos Gonzalez this year. Now, 94.8 miles per hour, that's on the average of his maximum effort throws. If we're going to go back and look at the last 3 years, it's Carlos Gomez, 95.9. Even this year, he was one of only seven outfielders who had a throw track at 100 miles an hour. Carlos Gonzalez had a pretty disappointing year by his standards. I think we both joked multiple times that a one-year $10 million deal in Baltimore is just like the most obvious contract that could ever happen. But it does look like the throwing arm is at least still intact, and he was a better hitter as the season ended.
For sure.
What I really like using the StatCast for is looking at undervalued batters and undervalued pitchers. And here's a pair of names that will either make me look like an absolute genius, or people will like refer to this forever as this guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
You're just giving the numbers.
I'm just giving the numbers. Let me explain how we got to these. You can look at expected weighted on base, and that's just quality of contact, right? It's what would have been expected to happen based on the amount of contact and the quality of contact. And then when you compare that to what actually happened, you can sort of get to, you know, fortunate outcomes. Obviously, foot speed comes into this a little bit, and ballpark effects for sure. So when I look at an undervalued batter, and remember the league average is about a 320, I see a guy who had an expected weighted on base of 321 and an actual weighted on base of 274, which, to be fair, is brutal. That's Hyunsoo Kim, who was with the Orioles and was very good in his debut in 2016 at a 382 on base and a 422 slugging. Last year, 307 on base, 292 slugging, got traded in that weird deal to the Phillies where he was just nailed to the bench behind everybody. So he's a free agent. He's gone back home, but he has said he wants to play in Major League Baseball next year. He had a 36% hard hit rate both years. Last year, his percentage of batted balls that were fly balls and line drives actually went up. It was 38, and then it was 43. I mean, those are good signs. I know the outcomes weren't there, but as a platoon outfield bat, you could do worse.
Emphasis on platoon. He is an extreme.
Oh, he cannot hit lefties.
I mean, I think his first year, he had zero home runs against lefties, and also they barely
he had zero hits.
He had zero hits. That's it. They didn't. He had like 36 plate appearances.
It was like 0-for-23 or something like
that. He's an extreme platoon player.
Yeah. This is where the numbers. And I'm not saying Kim is going to be an all-star next year or anything like that. Unless he is, and then I'm definitely saying that. Undervalued pitcher. I think this is an interesting name. 329 expected weighted on base, so like league average. 386 actual weighted on base. A 641 ERA. Anibal Sanchez, who has in the past been a very successful pitcher. I think he led the AL in ERA 1 year. Why do I like Anibal Sanchez? I think part of the outcome is, you know, the Tigers had the weakest defense in the American League. That certainly didn't help. But when you look a little deeper, obviously we just said the quality of contact was about league average. 21.6% K rate, that was major league average. 6% walk rate, that was better than major league average. And when he came back from the DL in August, he had one really bad start, 7 earned runs and 4 2/3 to Toronto. And then his final 4 starts of the season were really good. 23 innings, 274 ERA, a 31-7 strikeout to walk ratio. You can probably get him on a minor league deal, I would think, after the year he's had. And that is a guy I would bet on. He's had history of success in the past, and the underlying metrics are a little bit better than the obviously brutal 641 ERA, which is what I think a lot of people will be looking at.
Yeah, for sure. No, that's the Tigers had a weird year, and there's some things could get masked by the defense. I think that he's exactly, maybe not him, maybe there's a step up from him, but he's exactly the kind of guy, it's like, I'd rather roll the dice, bring in three guys like him than go and get Arrieta.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that, depending on what situation your team is in. We also always look at spin rate, right? And we know that Charlie Morton, for example, the Astros liked his curveball spin, and they brought him in last year, and he was fantastic. So if you want to bet on spin rate, Tyson Ross is an interesting name. I know Tyson Ross had a brutal year, and this is a good example that spin rate does not automatically make you successful, in the same way that velocity does not automatically make you successful, but it's a tool that you have, and if you can get with the right pitching staff, with the right coach, maybe you can use that to your advantage. Tyson Ross's four-seamer was clocked at 2,557 RPM. That is the second highest among 223 starters who threw 100 four-seamers. That is a skill, right? And he's got to be able to use it. He's got to be able to stay healthy. That's always his issue. But he is a guy I could definitely see a forward-facing analytical team bring in and say, we think we can maybe help you with this and mold you into not a star, but a useful pitcher.
I mean, with him, the issue at this point is just health. He's just been able to stay healthy for about 3 seasons now. But he's shown in his career he can be an effective pitcher when he's healthy. And he's, again, he's definitely much more of like a real, you know, sort of flyer. But he'll get a job. There will be teams that want him.
Also on that list, Mike Minor. And Mike Minor is a little different than Ross in that Mike Minor actually had a fantastic season. I think he ended up as the closer in Kansas City for a while. If you look at his four-seamer, it was actually higher than Tyson Ross's, 2,604 RPM. If you look at all of the pitchers, starters, and relievers who threw 100 fastballs, 493 of them, that was the fourth highest. And obviously, he's already used that to good effect because he had a great season. He's a guy who's going to get, like, I don't know, 3 years and $35 million to be some team's not closer, I don't think, but get me 5 or 6 outs. He'd fit pretty much anywhere.
Yeah, if a good rule of thumb with four-seam spin rate is usually, like, for starting pitchers, 2,500 is, like, the best of the best. That's where you see Tyson Ross, Max Scherzer, Justin Verlander. Relievers, often you see a little bit higher because, you know, obviously they come in short spurts and have a little more zip to it, and that's where you get Minor up above 2,600 on average.
And the final guy we want to talk about, and I'm going to talk about him in a little bit more depth because he's going to be my guy as the offseason goes on, Tyler Chatwood, who pitched the Rockies. He has a very high spin curveball. His curveball was clocked at 2,972 RPM. That's the fourth highest among the 149 starters.
Almost Lugo-esque.
And so Tyler Chatwood, let's talk about him for a second. He is my pick as the next Charlie Morton, right? Charlie Morton was a guy who kind of struggled for many years, came to Houston because they liked, you know, his underlying data, and obviously you saw Charlie Morton was a huge part of winning a World Series this year. Tyler Chatwood, 28 years old in December, career 4.31 ERA. For those who care, 40 wins and 46 losses. He's had two Tommy Johns, one way back in high school in 2006, one with the Rockies where he missed all of 2015, missed some time with a calf injury this year. And, you know, his overall year this year, not terribly impressive, but let's look at some of the underlying data. As I said, extremely high curveball spin. He's also got a very high spin fastball as well. His fastball was clocked at 2480. That is the 10th highest among those 223 who threw a 100. So right away, you've got a high spin curveball and a high spin fastball. But we also know that he was pitching in Colorado, which means he didn't really want to use the curveball as much. And what's fascinating about that is when you look at his home road splits, they're huge. And then also briefly, as a reminder for the Charlie Morton experience, his four-seam velocity jumped from 93.9 to 95.3. That sounds like Charlie Morton to me. If you look at Tyler Chatwood's overall expected weighted on base as a starting pitcher, it was 329, a little bit higher than average, 115th of 187 guys who faced 200, similar to Andrew Kashner, Nick Pivetta, and here it is, similar to Luis Perdomo. We did it. We got his name in this week. You know, basically the point is overall quality of contact, he was okay. He wasn't great. Now, obviously, if you look at home road splits, when he pitched in Colorado, he was a mess. 6.01 ERA in 70 and a third innings. That's a 3.45 expected weighted on base and a 3.83 actual weighted on base. How bad is a 3.83? There were 347 pitchers who had 100 plate appearances at home. That was 323rd. It's similar to Bronson Arroyo and Bartolo Colon, not exactly the names you want to be held up against in 2017. On the road, he was so much better. 3.49 ERA in 77 and a third innings. 3.07 expected weighted on base, a 3.04 actual weighted on base. Of the 317 pitchers who faced 100 plate appearances on the road, that was 89. That was similar to Greinke. That was similar to Michael Fulmer. If his road 307 expected weighted on base was his full season mark, it would have been 57th of 187, similar to Sonny Gray, Garrett Cole, and Justin Verlander. I like Tyler Chatwood. Some team is going to get him out of Colorado. They're going to use his spin to good effect, and they're going to be very happy about it.
All right. You heard it here first, folks.
Yeah, you have nothing else to add to the Tyler Chatwood experience.
No, I mean, he's an interesting test case, because obviously we've seen, you know, as the Rockies try different types of pitchers, you know, in Coors Field, and they've shown how certain types of pitchers can have success, usually ones that have dominant fastballs and dominant and exceptional fastball command. We've seen Jonathan Gray potentially develop into what could be like a true ace in Colorado, and we've seen in the past pitchers have elite seasons there. Ubaldo Jimenez is the name that always comes to mind. He had like a true Cy Young caliber season pitching in Coors is like a with a dominant two-seam fastball. But fastball curveball guys generally have not had as much success because the curveball is marginalized. So Chatwood is a good test case as someone who can did you happen to look up how much his curveball usage changes on road home versus road?
I don't have it handy, but a little bit. I don't think as much as you would expect. And I understand that. You don't want to be a totally different pitcher like from this start to the next, but I do think if he goes somewhere where it's not, you know, a mile high, some team will be able to say, hey, look, you can be a guy who can really use your curveball effectively.
I mean, you could go back to the Astros for a second, Lance McCullers, who basically just now says, well, like, my curveball's my best pitch, so I'm just going to throw that the most.
Yeah, I'm going to throw it 24 times in a row.
So, you know, maybe Tyler Chatwood becomes one of these guys who suddenly is throwing his curveball 45, 50% of the time as opposed to 20, 25% of the time.
Well, you heard it here first, the first week of November. I am on board the Tyler Chatwood train. That's our show for this week. And as a reminder, we are going to do the show each week for the entire offseason. Breaks around the holidays, of course. But keep tuning in because there's going to be so much to talk about. I'm Mike Petriello. This is Matt Myers. And this has been the MLB.com StatCast podcast.